From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Alcoa Presents the Midnight Movie Cowboys. I am your host, Hunter Dusing. And with me is a hapless gentleman, a normal Joe, Mr. John Grace. Say hello, John.
Hello.
He's one of our players tonight. this week, we're talking about, people talk a lot about horror movies, but you don't hear a lot of talk about the old anthology shows. You know, and if you do, you hear about The Twilight Zone. You don't hear about the Outer Limits unless the episode was written by Harlan Ellison. I'm going to stop talking like a host now.
And all of his stuff is in the second season. He wasn't even in the really proper first season.
Yeah.
Where all the great episodes are.
And but this week we're going to talk about an episode of One Step Beyond, or Alcoa Presents One Step Beyond. What is Alcoa anyway?
I would actually have to Google that, which I meant to do.
Yeah, I meant to look it up too, and I forgot.
It's probably one of these companies that was purchased by Nabisco or Kellogg's and completely just. It seems like they were insurance or something. Let's see.
Oh, Alcoa's logo was designed by Saul Bass. Look at that.
They are now an aluminum company. I don't know if they were in the 50s, but maybe they were an aluminum company back then. Hmm. I don't know why.
I know when Adam Carolla does his segment, Definitely Not a Jew, it's called Alcoa Presents Definitely Not a Jew.
Well, you know, his dad did write the mole, or no, his grandfather wrote the mole people. Or
yes,
something.
Yeah, Laszlo Gorog.
He wrote the mole people.
Yeah. My grandfather wrote Oscar-nominated films, but he's remembered for this piece of shit sci-fi movie that was done on Mystery Science Theater.
But, Alcoa, back then, the sponsor really, financed the show.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when the CBS did the 80s revival of The Twilight Zone, which disappeared pretty quickly after about 2 years on the network. But it had some good episodes. But it would start off with this. The Grateful Dead had recorded a new theme for The Twilight Zone, basically just covering it and giving it an 80s sound. And then it would just completely ruin the mood, where right after the credits, it would be like, The Twilight Zone is brought to you by Tide. Getting those stains out, and then specially Tide. And also, Calgon. But it just ruined everything. Completely killed the mood. Bad enough you're gonna have to see these commercials for 80s movies like Porky's 10 or whatever, but you know,
you'd be worried about whether or not the Velvet Elvis killed the grandma and stressing about that. Then you'd be thinking about Tide.
Exactly. You know, Tide. Because they had this old announcer that has since like the 50s, and boy, you could tell. And it's funny because John Newland, the host of One Step Beyond, will mention Alcoa, but he doesn't actually plug it, which has me thinking that the DVD prints or the Hulu prints probably get rid of the ads.
Yeah.
Which is probably a good thing, because I cannot stand, when I'm listening to The Shadow on Old Time Radio and there's a Blue Coal ad or a Brooks Brothers ad or whatever, and it just gets annoying.
Right. It reminds you that all this content is just made to sell shit.
Right. I mean, it's something that Majel Barrett, who used to be on Star Trek, and she would get asked all these silly questions at conventions of people reading too much into goddamn Star Trek, and she would say it was just designed to sell toothpaste.
Yeah, calm down.
That show was made for. It's not. It wasn't meant to change the world. It was just meant to sell toothpaste to on Friday nights.
It's content for television.
Right. It's TV. It's just selling you. And here, they were selling you aluminum or something, but under the idea that probably for stock investment or electronics. I have no idea.
I don't know what.
When you look, the Koch brothers presents the Twilight Zone.
The Koch brothers.
Protested man.
Yeah.
But
Monsanto presents.
Right. Monsanto presents the Outer Limits. Monsanto tonight, presents the Anti-Misfits.
Monsanto presents The Walking Dead.
That would be awesome.
Oh, that would be so rad.
That applies to its fans and its protesters. Yeah. But, yeah, One Step Beyond was sort of the idea of the paranormal, of course, was prime fodder for low-budget television every week and black and white. Absolutely perfect for it back then. Wasn't dependent on – horror itself was not dependent on, like, visceral thrills and gore and, you know, the nonsense that goes on today where it's all shot like an action movie.
Is well, the episode on of One Step Beyond we're talking about, it's not even a scary episode, really.
No, it's really
acting. It's just a ghost story.
Yeah, it's a ghost story. It's very well done. It's got some suspense in it. It's got the timing. The episode we're referring to is The Dead Part of the House, Season 1, Episode 9. In it, a young girl and her father have moved in with the sister to get over the death of the mother. And it's never fully explained to us what the deal is, but somehow the father blames the daughter for the death of the mother.
Yeah, he's not
dealing. It's all very read between the lines. And they're not getting along, but then the girl is talking to three dolls in her room, which is, you know, they write off as imaginary play. And, of course, in reality, she's talking to three ghosts that have haunted the house for decades, which we find out from the Chinese butler, played by Philip Ahn, who was later one of the masters on Kung Fu. And he's using absolutely terrible pidgin English that was required of all Chinese actors.
Oh, I American. Know. I was kind of cringing at the dialogue.
Yeah, like a certain lack of L pronunciation or troublesome L's or whatever. But it's...
And he would leave
or no,
out
no R's. It's the R's that they always thought
and,
Chinese.
And he would always and he left out like the's and stuff like that. Where you know just like talking like a primitive caveman.
Right. That was and of course, then he explains the whole story because you have all these great moments in that show, and it's all based on the acting where the actors react as if they're talking to ghosts or they've seen ghosts. And I found like the episode to be pretty exceptional. Like I had this one of those cheap box sets with all the public domain prints of One Step Beyond that they could cram in there. It wasn't the entire series, but I was watching one after the other, and they were there would be a good episode where Charles Bronson played a haunted boxer. That was pretty decent. But then there would be like a really obvious dull one where this woman's having nightmares about a sinking ship. The next day, she's boarding the Titanic with her husband. And then John Newland comes on. Well, I think we know how that story is going to end. You know, and it's kind of quasi John Lovett's voice. And I saw this episode and it totally stood out. The acting was a bit better than usual and the story was a bit better. And it actually had a great benefit, which was a very talented child actress, which made all the difference. Played by, I believe, Mimi Gibson, I believe is the young girl in this, who was a very successful child actress of that era. And it was one of those that when she turned 18, her parents had spent all her earnings.
Oh, God.
Yes.
It's so, like, what's his name? Jackie Coogan?
Yes.
Yeah.
And God, it went on to Gary Coleman. I mean, you would think a couple of decades later, these kids would get wise, or agents at least would get wise and look out for the kid. But it
well,
just
I think didn't some laws get passed because of Jackie Coogan? Like, didn't he lobby
and
for that?
And Mimi Gibson in this episode, when she grew up, she and other child actors, you know, who had grown into adults, started a big activist organization to protect child actors and their earnings.
Yeah.
Because they, you know, they got the burn of it. It's like, and she's really good in this. And it's interesting how these child actors, they never... If they're really good, they don't seem to grow into adult acting. It's like maybe they get tired of it and burn out on it early on. And it's like, but I want to do this as an adult and try to stay 120 pounds. And, you know,
right. Like a lot of like Macaulay Culkin just tours in a pizza-themed Velvet Underground band. I guess
no interest in, has he been in any of that? I don't think he's acted in much since.
He very rarely shows up in things. Like, rarely. Right. I saw some interview with him at some point where he said he gets offers like for stuff daily, but it's very rare that he does anything because he doesn't have to.
Right. Yeah, he made enough money.
And I think he's so reclusive that there's like, I think that's why there's all these rumors about him slamming heroin and stuff.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Man, who could blame him? I think the best thing you can do after you made your money is just don't work in the industry again.
Yeah, just see ya. Was it that Mara Wilson, who was in all those movies in the 90s, she's like a blogger now or something, you know, like...
Oh, I wouldn't even know the name. I don't watch a lot of 90s
movies. Well, it's when I grew up, you know, she was in stuff like Miss Doubtfire. She was in like Matilda and stuff like that.
Okay, I want everybody to know, Hunter is young enough to be my son if I was a very randy 12-year-old.
Yeah.
Just if you want to know the generation gap here.
Yeah.
But, But yeah, it's in this episode, I thought was pretty exceptional. There's not really a false note in the cast. It's very brief. It's only probably runs a total of 23 minutes if you watch it without commercials. I mean, it's they always say based on a true story. This is absolutely not based on a true story, but it's a very well done ghost story. And it's there's no special effects whatsoever.
None.
It's all based on acting and someone shouting from the other room. It's perfectly done. You could easily do this as a play.
Yeah, it was.
If you have the right setup and everything for the stage, this could be a stage play easily.
Yeah, and the I thought the relationship between the father and the daughter was a pretty intense theme for a TV show at the time.
Yeah,
like this daughter, this man who blames himself for. I mean, he blames his daughter for his wife's death, and this girl trying to deal with it, escaping yeah. through this ghost fantasy, or is it thing? You know,
yeah.
It
was, until there's an encounter,
yeah.
You know, and I don't want to ruin it because I know probably nobody listening to this has seen it, but it's extremely effective. And one scene just involves somebody screaming in another room.
Yeah,
and I was like, whoa, you know, and. Nobody does anything like this today. Everybody made a big deal about the Blair Witch Project because it basically had nothing. And it was mm-hmm. just all shaky cameras and crap. And unfortunately, everybody picked up on that. Without yeah. realizing there's ways to do that type of horror that have been done for years. Mm-hmm. And like this, that are very easy. And you don't have to give me nausea while I'm watching it.
And it doesn't have to be washed out. It doesn't have to have this bleak look, you know.
Right, it doesn't have to be shot like an action movie. I don't have to hear Freebird and see gunfights like a wannabe Peckinpah. You can do real, genuine horror. The funny thing is, the guy who figured this out was M. Night Shyamalan, but he's kind of blown his career with right. kind of rehashing the same twist-oriented film over and over again.
Yeah, because I would say that with the Sixth early Sense work, or something was like
yeah, the
that.
Sixth Sense is definitely in this style, and you can tell Shyamalan is... seen his share of One Step Beyonds and Twilight Zones. And I've even joked, I've been kind of yapping with Gian Quasar on Facebook, who's one of these paranormal investigator types, but, you know, very skeptical. He's not like, oh, yeah, I believe this is all real. He debunks it. And we were talking about how the Amityville Horror was inspired by The Exorcist. And I always say, you know, I think every time I watch a One Step Beyond or I watch Boris Karloff's Thriller, I think I'm going to see something that was described in the Amityville Horror.
Yeah. Because
they were totally inspired by TV. It's like the Betty and Barney Hill case that UFO fanatics go crazy for. This has never been debunked. They never disproved it. These people were put under hypnosis, and there was a TV movie with, like, I think James Earl Jones playing Barney Hill. And it was the first of the Grays, the big dark-eyed aliens,
bald
heads and the gray skin. This was the first description. Well, some skeptics looked at that case and found out that the Outer Limits episode with similar described aliens aired like a week or two before or the same month. Mm. So they think Betty and Barney Hill's story was completely inspired by the Outer Limits episode they probably watched.
Yeah.
But back then, when they were recording their story, nobody thought about, oh, well, let's actually look at a skeptical possibility here that it was inspired. Because before that, UFOs... when they were described, it was always a beautiful woman stepped out of the ship, you know, a cyclops. And then after the Betty and Barney Hill case, it was always the Grays. It completely became the Grays after that. And it's inspired by an Outer Limits episode. It's just a powerful self-hypnosis that occurs. So I'm sure with these ghost stories, very inspired by One Step Beyond, which was a very popular show in its day, and did play syndication quite a bit in the 70s, at least when I was a kid.
Yeah, my dad even talks about watching this.
And it predates the Twilight Zone, I should add.
Yeah. yes, correct. And it's because a lot of people think Twilight Zone's the original, like, anthology, you know, sort of.
There was One Step Beyond. There was Science Fiction Theater. There was Tales from Tomorrow. There was actually several different shows.
Tales from Tomorrow. Sorry.
Which, when they were all just like the Twilight Zone, inspired by similar anthology shows on old-time radio in the 1940s. And you know, the funny thing was, and also, by the way, before Art Bell and before Larry King took the spot overnights in the 70s, Long John Neville out of New York was doing all-night radio, which covered paranormal, CIA brainwashing, conspiracies, all that stuff. So that was – and he was on a at that time, I think it was WOR radio, which at that time was a blowtorch radio station you could hear across the country at night. And Long John Neville is extraordinarily popular, and you can find his old shows on YouTube. But that had a lot of this. So your whole alternative science fiction, horror, suspense, paranormal, play kind of one hand in fiction and one hand in nonfiction, it was really all over the place back then. It wasn't like an obscure thing. I think it's actually more obscure now, believe it or not.
Yeah.
I mean, I really do. It's like, because when we think horror, we think Walking Dead or we think Friday the 13th.
Right. Or, like, even the gore obsession with horror is extended to television with The Walking Dead, you know?
Yeah, and it's like, horror used to be this sort of, like, somewhat sophisticated. Because One Step Beyond, you can't really say it's a kid's show.
No.
Because
if I was a kid, I would have been bored shitless by that.
Exactly.
Episode.
And I didn't like this when I saw it as a kid. I didn't have the patience for it. It's like, come on, a monster needs to come out.
Yeah.
You know? And Lou Costello needs to run around screaming or something.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And it's completely suspenseful and it's tastefully done. It's actually good television. Not every episode of One Step Beyond is as good as this one, but I think it's a unique little piece. And you can find it on YouTube. It's also on Hulu. You can watch One Step Beyond on Hulu. And there's a decent DVD set that came out of a season one recently by an actual company that got the masters, the same one seen on Hulu, which are pretty nice looking. So I was actually glad to see a cleaned up print of this on Hulu after suffering through my blurry, fuzzy public domain copy from Mill Creek.
And, I was thinking that the anthology format today, you know, there have been like attempts at it, like Masters of Horror and Masters of Science Fiction and stuff like that. But
yeah.
Now it's the season, like American Horror Story, True Detective, where you get a different season-long story with a new set of characters, which, if you get a good story, is pretty good. But, like, I haven't seen season two of True Detective, but a lot of people were like, you know?
I haven't heard one good thing about it.
Everybody said it was kind of a slog to get through. So, and like, if you get...
Funny,
like, that would be...
To me, you know, okay, this is what's so funny to me. They're basically doing the Wise Guy format. Because the Ken Walsh show, Wise Guy, would do the season-long arcs of story, one villain. Yes.
I did not know that.
That's the show that started that, the arc. And then it would wrap up at the end of the season, or mid-season. Sometimes it would run two arcs in one season. And it was a cult show, but it seems like everybody who watched it later wrote TV shows.
Right.
People like Joss Whedon and some of these other guys.
When was this show on?
Wise Guy, I think it was 1986 or 1987.
Okay.
And ran for a couple of years, had a cult following, had the notoriety of... It ran on CBS. Had the notoriety of spoofing Twin Peaks before Twin Peaks aired.
Huh.
Yes, they ran a Twin Peaks parody arc story months before Twin Peaks, because Twin Peaks was delayed for like a year.
So they were planning on it playing when Twin Peaks was on, and then it didn't line up.
And the theory was one of the writers or directors saw the Twin Peaks pilot at a festival, at a film festival possibly in Europe, and then decided to do a satire on it. And it's pretty fascinating to watch. It was I think it was called a Lynchburg arc or something. But if you It was pretty fun. Yeah, I mean, all the references were there, but they were making fun of Twin Peaks before Twin Peaks aired.
It's funny. I got to see this show.
It's pretty unique, but I love the show. Garon Ligoshin is actually a huge fan, too, and I turned him on to it, and we were just obsessed with it. And it is available on DVD. You don't get all the arcs because they had an arc of the music industry that they cannot clear the music royalties for. So you have to buy bootlegs of that one. But that show has always had like a very strong cult following, and it was a Stephen Canal show, so it was part of the Stephen Canal empire, but he didn't clear the music, you know, music clearance. And in one episode, the music is extremely important. And, they changed the music to something generic instead of the Moody Blues Nights in White Satin, and completely kind of hurts the mood of the scenes. But
it's whenever that happens, you know, the changing of music, it's like a turd in the punt in the swimming pool.
I've been watching Hunter, the Fred Dreyer show, and I started from season one, and I remember when I was a kid, this was the same year that Miami Vice started airing on NBC, and was unique at the time because it had the real recordings, it had the real songs, like you know, In the Air Tonight was sung by Phil Collins. If you watched a Glenn Larson show at the time, it would always be a cover artist and a cover version.
Right.
So you'd get like a fake Huey Lewis Heart of Rock and Roll that sounded nothing like, sounded even worse than Huey Lewis. Hey, Heart of Rock and Roll.
Yeah.
And the sax sounded off or what. And Miami Vice had the real songs. Well, Hunter also had music like on it. It was like, wow, they're really playing Creedence Clearwater's Bad Moon Rising. And then it was like, whoa, they had one episode. I don't know how they did it. It must have been easier to license the Rolling Stones music back then. They had one episode based around a hitman killing people with Sympathy for the Devil playing.
Really?
Yeah, through the whole episode.
Oh, my gosh.
And of course, on DVD, because it was released by Mill Creek, and they're not going to pony up for those music clearances.
No.
So forget the royalties. They have – it's all different cover songs by Mike Post and – whoever was doing music for the shows at the time. And, you know, it's just generic music. And it's funny, I just found out if you get the Hunter DVDs from Germany, which I wish I had the money to do right now, but I can't, the first season has the original songs.
Really? Okay.
In Germany, they don't care. And yeah, they don't
just
worry about
music. They just release it.
It's practically public domain over there. Or they cleared it because clearing it in Germany is a lot cheaper than clearing it in the U.S. And there was a canal show called Booker that I liked with Richard Grieco that was spun off from 21 Jump Street. It was way better than 21 Jump Street. It was actually an attempt at doing a hip detective show. And I got the set from Australia, which was expensive. Mm-hmm. But it has all the music. The theme song by Billy Idol, which was Hot in the City. There's one episode completely revolving around stealing B.B. King's guitar, and you hear B.B. King's guitar riffs throughout the whole episode. Hilarious show, and Mill Creek released it. They didn't even include the B.B. King episode.
Oh.
It's not even on their set, and that set goes for crazy money on eBay. But the Australian set has all the music, so I was like, get the Australian set. Get a recommendation from Stu over who to call in Australia to get it. But
to get it, yeah. Like
Jamie if you Hi-Fi must, your old, forgotten, obscure Stephen Canal shows, you know. But yeah, the music clearance is really important.
Yeah, and it really is.
And I don't know why they don't sign better deals when they air these shows, but I guess they never saw there would be home video would be.
Yeah, I don't think they ever predicted that this would be a thing, you know, that they would have
You're going to own a Fred Dreyer show?
Yeah.
Are you kidding me?
Like, I think they never could fathom that people would be taking these home. You know, it was just content for television. And
Right. It was to sell, you know, Slim Whitman albums or whatever the hell they were advertising.
Mm-hmm.
Or it was to sell the Super Bowl, or it was to sell, you know, Ginsu knives. It was not, or deodorant. It was just the idea was never anybody would actually want to buy these and watch them again.
Yeah, like the idea was if it was going to live on, it would be through syndication, you know.
Yes, yeah, and then you didn't worry about it then. You probably had a 5-year option on music, and it didn't matter.
Yeah, so, But so let's go to the next show we're going to talk about is Boris Karloff's Thriller.
Yes.
And this is another show my dad fondly remembers seeing.
Your dad's pretty old, right?
Yeah, he's 60.
Yeah, he's a bit older than I am.
Yeah. So, you know, he would have been watching this like in the 60s when he was a kid.
Right.
Because he was born in 55.
Okay, he would have seen this.
You know, and I've always heard a lot about this show. I have never actually seen it until now. Mm-hmm. And
same here.
Really?
Yes. It was not a popular syndication item.
Hard
to get on video until the DVD set came out a few years ago.
And I was kind of shocked when I started this episode and it stars William Shatner.
Yes, before he was Captain Kirk.
He was
the Richard Burton of Canada for television.
Pretty much, yeah. He was in this and, you know, important, quote-unquote, Roger Corman movies like The Intruder.
Right. All right, as Stuart told me, this episode should be called The Grim Reaper.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Shatner style.
Oh, real quick. We need to do ratings for that episode.
The dead part of the house.
The dead part of the house. What would you give it?
I give it an 8. And in comparison to other One Step Beyond episodes, it's a 10.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Because, I mean, it's not an outstanding show, but it's like that episode is a lot better than the average show from One Step Beyond.
Yeah, I'd give it an 8 as well, because I think it's got really strong writing and acting, and it's very economical at 25 minutes.
And I miss that type of television.
Yeah, it's just, like, I was like, man, you know, there's not really a lot of wasted dialogue. It's really, and the characters are really well done. I was just like, man, you know, getting all of that, accomplishing this arc that works in 25 minutes, that is remarkable.
And I'll tell you this, if you compared this to something like from the 80s, like Tales from the Dark Side or Monsters, you'd realize how goddamn awesome One Step Beyond actually is, because Monsters and Tales from the Dark Side would put my ass to sleep so quick when I was a kid, because it was so, they would drag. They would only be 20 minutes, but they would feel like 2 hours.
Yeah. If your 20-minute film doesn't fly by, there's something wrong with it.
Yeah.
And Stuart says he gives it a 6.5 in a message he gave.
Oh.
So he wasn't as big on it as we were. So anyway, back to Thriller.
Because one of them just slapped the kid, mate.
Yeah. Stuart was like, why didn't the kid just shut up?
He's like, shut up. I'm working here.
You're working here. That's the man grieve for his wife already.
I mean, and why was it the butler and Abu?
Oh, look, we're watching a movie where Slopes ain't stabbing each other.
Yeah, you just throw in Tasteless Stewart Asian joke, and there you go. Yeah, there's Stuart's review.
There we go. It's like he's here with us.
Nothing came out of the water, mate, so I wasn't scared. So
Thriller, hosted by Boris Karloff. Yeah. It's called Boris Karloff's Thriller, but I think he just presented it, you know.
He's putting his name on it, because there was also a comic book at the time called Boris Karloff's Tales of Horror, and then it would be like Boris Karloff's Tales of Mystery, the Boris Karloff's Tales of the Unexpected, and there was a like Gold Key Comics tied in with Boris Karloff always for their anthologies.
Mm-hmm.
And so Boris Karloff in the 50s and 60s, because the Universal horror movies were being seen on television in syndication for shock theater. So Boris Karloff equaled horror and thrills kids. That was the brand name. That was like what Wes Craven's name is today. And Miramax is always Wes Craven's name on movies he really didn't do anything with.
Yeah, I mean, it was like collecting a paycheck for Wes, basically. Right. Wes Craven's Dracula 2000.
Because the name equaled horror, so it's Boris Karloff's this and Boris Karloff's that. And he was probably the most popular horror actor of the 60s, even though he was old and basically taking cameo roles or just very small supporting roles and not really starring in much at the time.
Hey, it's a good gig if you can get it.
Definitely. And still had a great voice and great presentation and in camera presence for television.
Yeah, when I was watching him present it, I was like, gosh, you know, like that gravitas is just so great.
I feel there's going to be something wrong tonight. You know,
right? I believe you, Boris.
Yeah, and it's like, oh, you know, it's like, oh, the Grim Reaper. You know, it's like this painting. It's even better than just about any other actor you could think of, other than Vincent Price, but without the kind of fey context. You know.
Yeah, Vincent Price. Oh, the Grim Reaper.
Do you know how much it bothered me? Like when I was a teenager, I realized how gay Vincent Price seemed, because I didn't pick up on it when I was 9 or 10, because who knew what that was? Gay meant you were happy. It's like Vincent Price is just very elegant and British or something. Yeah. Then I found out that he wasn't really British.
Oh no, he's from St. Louis.
Yeah, and it's like, what? It's just like,
wait a second, something's wrong here.
Oh my. But supposedly it's never proven that he had that lifestyle.
No, I think I think he had a family and such. And
yeah, he did. He had a family, and his daughter investigated and couldn't prove that he'd actually been gay or of any sort. You know,
the Kenneth
Anger Hollywood Babylon level rumors were always there, but what's funny is if you look at him in like the 30s and early 40s, he was like promoted as sort of a tough guy.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was a big dude.
What's his name? Sam Fuller's, like, Baron of Arizona. Like, he was in some of these westerns, right?
Yeah, he did a lot of westerns. He played the Saint on television. The funny thing, not television, excuse me, radio. He did the old-type radio Saint. Problem is, he sounds so fey as the Saint.
Hello, I am the Saint.
Yeah, it really came out. It's Simon Templar.
I am here to...
I was listening to one of them, and it was like... Like some girl staying with him was like, "Don't worry, I'll sleep on the couch."
Oh, a woman! I don't think I'll be sleeping in bed with you tonight.
It was like that. It was
on the couch. Because I'm a gentleman.
Listener a bone, and they were like, "Well, just sound British to the listeners, because everybody knows the Saint is a British creation." So, but Boris Karloff, I think, had a far scarier presence for this, and was just a perfect host, you know.
Oh, yes, the Grim Reaper, Boris. Tell me more.
Yeah, and Boris is just like, our players tonight are William Shatner.
Shatner. Yeah, that's great. I want him to announce everything. I love that when we announce the players.
Right.
So the story of this one is it opens with this guy going to visit this painter. He hasn't heard from him in a while, and he's hung himself, and he's just painted a picture of death. And it is the tackiest picture of death.
It's a Slayer album cover from the 1980s.
Well, I was about to say, it's a Slayer album cover. Like, we're talking like Show No Mercy era Slayer. Like,
right.
You know, like with, because, you know, those 80s thrash bands, like in 83 when they were putting out their first albums, all the album art is dog shit. Like Exodus is Bonded by Blood. Slayer's Show No Mercy, Anthrax's Fistful of Metal, like all these album covers were just crap.
Yeah, all the best metal covers were by a non-metal band like Molly Hatchet.
Yeah,
they would actually pay for Frank Frazetta paintings.
Oh yeah, people always tell stories about like seeing the Molly Hatchet covers and going like, "This looks awesome," and then they hear it and they're like, "What? This sounds like Lynyrd Skynyrd."
I'm flirting with disaster.
And they're like, "What the fuck?"
Yeah, I thought they would have sounded heavy even when I was a kid. I didn't even know much about heavy metal music. I was like, "Wow, this band must be badass." And then, of course, when I listen to them, it's just like, it's a third-rate Lynyrd Skynyrd impersonation.
Yeah, it's just like, oh, wait, this isn't that.
Yeah, and then you have the artist who hung himself. Yes. He hung himself, you know. our player, Natalie Schaefer, cut to the modern time. She plays a, was she an actress? I can't quite remember.
She was a mystery novelist.
Right, she was a novelist who had married a younger man who was an actor, who was like a soap opera actor.
Sort
of a cheap John Derek type actor who was like a lead.
The Shatner character says like, "Oh, my niece is a fan and she's 10.
She's a fan, too. She would love an autograph.
Yeah, you know, she's 10 years old, you know, he said.
Right, she's 10. Yeah. But it's not proper to speak of a 10-year-old that way.
Yeah,
but,
I'll invite her over, I'll claw her eyes out.
And then you also have the secretary played by Elizabeth, Scott Merrill plays the actor, by the way. And then Elizabeth Allen plays the secretary who basically pretty much types up Natalie Schaefer's novels. You know, they kind of joke she writes them, basically.
Yeah.
So Natalie Schaefer kind of knows that she's married the wrong guy and he's young and just there for her money, and feels like the secretary is also out to get her money.
She thinks the secretary's carousing with her husband.
And dotes on the nephew. And the husband's got the hots for the secretary, of course.
Yeah.
Even though, this, you know, the actor plays him like he's the fayest lead actor around, you know. He's a lot more Tab Hunter than John Wayne here.
Yeah.
And
should have been played by Vincent Price.
Yes.
Ooh, yes. I'm only here for the money. You see, I'm not interested in vaginas.
Price never said a dirty word at all.
No.
Very, very.
I am not interested in kitties.
Blue language. But she's purchased this Grim Reaper painting, and Shatner's character announces that this painting is cursed. And don't you read the Sunday supplements? And it's this repeated story that when the painting bleeds, the owner dies.
Yes.
Not to give too much away, because, again, I know most of our listeners have not seen this.
And it's got some good twists in there.
It's got some really good twists. The screenplay is by Robert Bloch. It's based on an old pulp story. Robert Bloch changed a lot around to adapt it for television. And
for those who don't know, Robert Bloch wrote Psycho.
He wrote the original novel. Didn't write the screenplay, but wrote the original
novel. Joseph Stefano wrote the script. He wrote the novel. And he wrote a lot of, like, sort of weird Lovecraftian fiction and, you know, lots of... Lots of good horse. He wrote episodes of Star Trek, too, I think.
Yeah, he was actually a very consistent writer. and it, for thrillers. It was still writing books up until is he still alive? I haven't even checked.
I think he's dead. Yeah, I think he's been dead a while.
He had to have. But
I think he passed away.
Yes, 1994 at age 77.
Yeah.
And he actually wrote episodes of Tales from the Dark Side, Speak of the Devil.
Oh.
But was collecting royalty paychecks off Psycho for a long time, I'm sure. He wrote a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
A lot of TV stuff.
You see his name pop up on shows like this a lot, you know.
Right. And at the time, he was a very respected novelist. Like, he came out, and I wouldn't say a lot of his, I read some of his 50s crime novels, which I thought were much better than his later horror novels, where there's a point where authors get to an age where they cannot really capture dialogue anymore.
Right.
Because they don't talk to people that much in the modern world, and they kind of lose their gift for dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of became obvious with some of Robert Bloch's later novels, but I would still recommend like reading anything he did in the 50s, and you know, if you come upon it. But yeah, very respectable writer. Also wrote the great anthology film, The House That Dripped Blood.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's a good one.
Fantastic John Pertwee performance, if you just think of him as one of the, you know, for me, the best Doctor Who. But absolutely great performance by Pertwee in that movie. But Robert Bloch always had a good sense of humor. There's a lot of that really good Bloch dialogue in this episode, and there's a lot of good jokes and humor. I mean, just the fact that Shatner's name is Paul Graves, as in Paul Bearer of Graves.
Yeah.
Or, you know, it's just, and Natalie Schaefer's character is Beatrice Graves. And I mean, you can just read so much into it. Like, Bloch put a lot of subtext in there that you don't get from entertainment today. They don't really have it, because if they did this today, they would show you everything. They would beat you over the head. There'd be no subtlety. There'd be no atmosphere. They would just beat you over the head with everything. It just wouldn't be suspenseful at all.
Like, I thought the final moment with one of the characters, the sort of climactic moment, I thought it was really effectively done. Like, I thought it was kind of chilling the way it was played out.
Yeah.
And I was just like, you know, and it's so good because I'm not looking at anything, you know. I could kind of get sucked into the moment.
It makes your brain do the work.
Yeah.
It really makes your brain do the work. It's funny because the previous episode on my DVD set, although you can find this on YouTube, I do recommend getting the Thriller box set. It's still in print. Still get it at Amazon. You can find it on eBay for under $40. They did Robert E. Howard's Pigeons from Hell.
Oh,
and
really?
If I'd known Stuart wasn't going to make the show, I would have said, oh, let's do Pigeons from Hell and the Grim Reaper.
Oh, we got to watch that.
You got to watch Pigeons from Hell. It is the most faithful Robert E. Howard adaptation in the film television medium, which, you know, sorry, Conan the Barbarian, not right. Solomon Kane, not quite there. Pigeons from Hell, they nailed it. It's just, it's basically the short story with a few modernizations, but it is the Robert E. Howard short story. Perfectly in black and white with very graphic violence. There is a hatchet in the head that scared the hell out of kids back then. And it's extremely gory for television. And Stephen King was contacted by a TV network producer in the 70s about maybe adapting his Night Shift show into an anthology thing. And he said, when I was a kid, I saw Pigeons from Hell on Thriller. And they had a scene of a guy with a hatchet in his head walking down the stairs. Could we do that scene today? And the guy said no. He goes, I don't want to do my stories for television.
What did you know?
And this is the 70s. They couldn't even show what they could show in Thriller.
Right.
In the early 60s.
Actually, in that episode, the Pigeons from Hell episode, was directed by John Newland.
Yes, I've one step beyond.
Oh, yeah.
Host and director of many episodes.
Got a little cross-pollination.
John Newland is very talented. When you watch One Step Beyond, even the mediocre episodes, they're still done with a lot of skill. It's just the predictability of the writing was not on the level. Newland didn't have the writers that he would have access to doing Thriller. Or I think he did another. He did a follow-up. I just found out recently he did a sequel show to One Step Beyond in the 70s called something like The Next Step Beyond,
I think.
And it was shot on video, and there's one or two episodes on YouTube, but it's not really as well made as the 50s TV show, because it was so, I think it was syndicated. I don't remember ever seeing this on television when I was a kid.
Yeah.
But I think it was a syndicated TV show being shot on video and everything, so it had like chroma key effects and stuff. But Newland directed Pigeons from Hell, and it was, man, he knocked it out of the park because that's like the best hour of horror I've seen from television. All and right. That's counting the episode of Twin Peaks, which revealed that Laura Palmer was killed by her father and he goes on a rampage. And like, I mean, that's a creepy ass episode. And I would have said that's the best hour of horror on television. But then I saw Pigeons from Hell and I said, this thing, John Newland knocked it out of the park. I wish he'd done like some movies, like some real thrillers. Like,
yeah, because he only directed TV, right?
Yeah, he was a TV guy. He directed, I think he directed episodes of Kolchak the Night Stalker. I know he appeared on it. And it's just, he was just one of those TV talents. It's yeah. And a lot of these guys never even thought, oh, I'll take my talents to movies. It just, they didn't bother because there was like, there was a real ghettoization of television versus movies.
It right, like it wasn't like today where...
There was, like Michael Moore would say, an apartheid.
An apartheid.
yes. But, yeah, it was a real division. And
yeah, the only director, I'm looking at thriller episodes, Ted Post directed an episode. He obviously did Dirty Harry sequel and, you know...
Good Guys Wear Black.
Yeah, oh, classic. No, but I see that Ray Milland actually directed an episode.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I can't wait to pour into those. I'm going to watch a lot of thrillers for, you know, October, being Halloween and all. And right. I don't feel like new horror films and reminding myself why I don't watch new horror. I'll watch old classic stuff I haven't seen. I am warned that the first season of Thriller apparently had a lot of crime episodes, kind of like old EC Comics crime episodes of bank robbers who disagree with each other over the loot. And then it just started leaning more to the horror side because everybody's like, it's Boris Karloff. Why don't we just do horror?
Yeah, exactly. You expect that's what you expect. That's what you want from Karloff.
Exactly. And I've said on the show before, I'm not a big Twilight Zone fan, but I have sworn that I'm going to go back and give the show another shot because, you know, I just like there's a respect for that style and the format and my disillusionment with new entertainment and people, you know, going crazy over an Eli Roth movie that I'm just like, okay. Or a remake of Halloween or whatever the hell they're putting out this year.
Was it Poltergeist recently got remade?
Yeah, and everybody forgets that too because it just came and went. Yeah. And there seemed to be an annual ripoff of The Exorcist every year too.
Like, oh, there's always the it's always like around January. You get
the possession
like,
of Ernie Schlotzenberg.
Yeah, there's The Last Exorcism, The Last Exorcism 2, The Devil Inside, you know.
The Devil's Got Your Throat, or something like that. You know? I wish they were more creative with the titles. You always said the greatest movie title ever was a Hong Kong movie, a comedy with Maggie Cheung and singer George Lamb called It's a Drink, It's a Bomb. And I said, that's the greatest title ever. If I ever wrote a script, I would just title it, It's a Drink, It's a Bomb, and let them pay the royalties to whatever's left of Cinema City or D&B Films or whoever financed that.
Drink.
But I thought, it was a D&B film, so I think the title's public domain. So I was like, It's a Drink, It's a Bomb. And it's the greatest title ever. That and Al versus Bombo, which was a Sammo Hung comedy.
Al versus Bombo.
And as a guy with a bomb. I think it was Al versus Dumbo, depending on what English title catalog you saw, but I've seen VCDs where it's called Al versus Bombo. But It's a Drink, It's a Bomb. But I'm gonna check out more Twilight Zones, even though that's more speculative science fiction though. It wasn't really
helpful. Yeah, it is more sci-fi. You get the occasional creepy episode, but
every message, like it's funny back then would be considered a liberal message and nowadays would be considered more of the fears and concerns of conservatives.
Yeah.
Because it's like individuality, fear of authority, fear of government. It's definitely, it's funny how the tide has really changed.
Isn't it funny how all you have to do is wait a while to go from being a radical to a conservative?
You know? I know. It's crazy.
Just wait a bit. Your views will change. You'll be considered right wing soon enough.
Exactly. Or, you know, even the Rockford Files, if you watch that today, it's like, it's concerned with corporate espionage and government surveillance. And back then it was a liberal show. Now it'd be considered conservative concerns.
Mm-hmm.
Good Lord, it's Tea Party propaganda.
Yeah, no, you know, you definitely see a lot of like the Breitbart writers and stuff are Rockford Files fans, you know.
Oh, yeah, they all love that. Like, because James Garner is the individual, which back then was a liberal value. And a conservative value, but now is basically the property of conservatives because liberals hate individualization for some reason.
Well, it's you know, it,
if you're an individual, you're an asshole, and you read Ayn Rand.
Yeah, it's
It, Jim Goad is an asshole, cause just like Ayn Rand, and anybody who's a libertarian, because they don't care about anybody.
All the writers for Tacky Magazine are on the Southern Poverty Law Center hate group list.
Oh, don't worry. Our podcast will be there soon.
Yeah, we'll be there.
If we have five more Stewart appearances and rants.
We'll
get Garrow back.
I was about to say, we just need one more Garrow appearance.
He'd probably be on their list if they could spell his name.
Yeah. They're worried they'll spell his name wrong, and then they'll be on the hate crime.
And then they'll say, you made this guy up.
Yeah.
There's nobody with this name. Yeah. But who else is going to be on the list? Him, Bobo, Pompanini?
Hopefully the Grim Reaper won't be coming for him anytime soon.
Oh boy, is he having a rough time.
Yeah, he is.
He gets pissed off at somebody, he has to go back to the hospital.
Yeah. I think recently he was ranting about one of a producer he fired from Dangerous People.
Yeah. Yeah, and then he ended up going back to the hospital.
Yeah. Poor Garrow.
We're making these jokes and he's probably getting fucking blasted with chemo right now.
Yeah.
Just because he got pissed off at some dickhead.
Yeah. He'll explain his
We're gonna have the Garrow comeback episode.
That's
gonna be titled, I can tell you right now, a very special
Midnight Movie Cowboys. Oh, we love Garrow so much. We'll be back. He'll be back on the show.
Yeah.
But anybody who's friends with him on Facebook knows what's going on. We're not telling any stories out of we're not airing his private information, anything he hasn't said on Facebook.
No.
So what would you give this episode? Is there anything else you wanted to say about it? Because I didn't want to give too much away.
I don't want to either, because I need it's just like Bad Day at Black Rock. We know most of you have not seen this. We want you to watch it. It's like you gotta give these old shows a chance. I mean, I think our listeners are a bit more sophisticated and a bit more intelligent and open-minded about this stuff. Because I get the messages, man, I'm going to check this stuff out you guys are talking about.
We'll put links to the YouTube clips in the description.
And consider investing in the Amazon box sets or go to Amazon.com, get the box sets or deep discount, wherever the hell you get these things.
They're all super cheap. I mean, I see them at Half Price Books for $10 all the time.
Exactly. And I have a strong feeling that I think the rest of the Thriller box set's going to be pretty amazing. Because just based on Pigeons from Hell and the Grim Reaper.
Yeah, that's I'm going to watch that one for sure.
Pigeons from Hell will blow you out of your seat, man. It's just like amazing. And it's the One Step Beyond host directed it. And it's like the best piece of horror I've seen in the medium in years. And but from what I can tell, Thriller is a high quality show. Wish it had been on longer, but when these shows are on longer, they tend to water down and they're not as good as second season viewers of The Outer Limits could tell you.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've suffered through these syndicated Twilight Zones and syndicated Outer Limits that they made in the 90s, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But yeah, check them out. This is it's a type of horror that deserves a little appreciation. Older television, actually, by today's standards, seems like art. They're not beating you over the head with the ads like Blindside or whatever the hell NBC's tattooed naked girl found in Times Square show is.
Oh my God, I don't even know about this.
Oh my God, they advertise it like crazy by starring the actress who almost played Wonder Woman until she ran her mouth off to the press.
Oh no.
Yeah, and so she was replaced by Gal Gadot.
Whatever her name is, Gal Gadot or whatever.
Yeah, she, and it's funny because the chick in the show who lost the role looks just like the Wonder Woman of the comics, so you could tell when you see the Blindside clips. She's in the Thor movie. I think she's the woman warrior from Asgard or whatever.
Okay, yeah.
You know who I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. And they were saying, oh, if you've been in a Marvel movie, you came in a DC movie. Well, she was about to prove that wrong, and then according to our pal Cameron at Obnoxious and Anonymous, he had... He said, no, she ran her mouth off to the geek sites, and they quoted her agent that she was meeting with Warner Brothers.
Oh, like, yeah.
Wonder Woman, and she was going to get the role. She had it. And, we kind of joke about Jason Momoa, how he played hard. He just wouldn't answer any questions about Aquaman.
Mm-mm.
Like, people would ask him, he'd go, what? Can't hear you, bro. I'm sorry. That's,
yeah, he would always be kind of coy about
right,
it.
Right, because he signed on the dotted line. You cannot talk about this. Yeah. So he can't do it. And she talked about it, and Warner Brothers was like, okay, can't keep a secret. The shit's important. Bam. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
You have no loyalty. You defied your oath of loyalty, so you're gone. We're going to rate the Grim Reaper?
Yes. We're going to do a rating. Stuart gives it a 9, so he really likes it.
Yeah.
What would you give it?
I give it a 9.
I'd give it an 8.
I'm going to tell you straight up, though. Pigeons from Hell, you're going to give it a 10.
Oh, I'm sure. Being a Robert E. Howard fan, that's like finding $20 in the dryer, you know?
I know. And I also speak as a big Robert E. Howard fan. I was just completely blown away. And people told me, it's like, you got to see it if you feel cheated by Robert E. Howard adaptations and all these asshole directors telling you you can't really do Robert E. Howard's writing as a movie or TV. It's like,
it's too racist.
It's too inappropriate. The characters are unlikable.
Yeah. It's misogynistic.
The Conan of the stories is too, he's a bastard. You can't portray that in television movies.
We have to make him mute slave.
a dumb, bloated little Abner. It's his ass kicked most of the movie.
Yeah.
You know, at least you got a cool Polidori score. Let's remember this movie 30 years later.
It's directed by the guy who wrote Apocalypse Now.
So it's got a lot of the same blowhard macho dialogue than some of his other work. but I think I put down that movie enough on this show. I'm going to have to start bashing some other movie that everybody loves, like The Unforgiven.
The Unforgiven. Oh, come on. You can't totally hate a Clint Eastwood film. Right?
I didn't care much for it. I just thought it was overrated. And I remember when you heard me say that on Damaged Viewing. Oh, God, did I say that show? You heard me say that. You called me up while I was on the way to the gym. You're like, what? You said you didn't like The Unforgiven? Is that what you said on the show, John? Are you okay?
Well, it was just because it's a Clint Eastwood movie. And, you know, I know it's – I don't consider it to be, like, a great Clint Eastwood movie.
Yeah.
But I think it's a pretty good one. Like, I don't think it's this great classic, but
– I think there's a better 88-minute movie inside that film.
Yeah. No,
that's what I felt walking out. I said – this could have been 88 minutes and been a lot better. Cut out the toilet humor. Cut out the, okay, the Old West wasn't heroic. We beat you over the head.
Oh,
the
I know.
Time.
Yeah, it's definitely got it's definitely got its sort of pretensions about the genre.
Yeah, and then at the end of the damn movie, he turns into Clint Eastwood of High Plains Drifters. Like, I'll kill anybody.
Yeah, exactly. You know?
Well, okay, you just blew your whole fucking thing
here.
Well,
that's the most rad part of the movie.
It's like he really just should have been shot dead in the saloon or something. You know, it's like that would have been an ending.
Should have armed himself. You know.
Yeah. Instead, he's Mr. Invincible gunfighter. You know, he's the High Plains Drifter right there, or Joe Munko, and our Josie Wales. It's just like, come on.
Yeah.
But because the 90s was such a bad decade for movies, everybody just overrated that one beyond belief.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I think that's fair. I mean, I don't think it's like this classic, but I was kind of shocked to hear you just slag it off, I guess, because I know what a Eastwood fan you are.
I like Clint Eastwood movies, but the truth is the bulk of them are terrible.
Yeah, well, fair enough.
I mean, I like them. I'll sit through them, and I'll watch some of them. But some of them, like, okay, I'll watch, like, The Gauntlet, and I'm like, oh, God.
Yeah.
This is bad. And
the best part about
The
Gauntlet is that Frank Frazetta poster.
Yes, that's better than the film itself. The jazz score is pretty good. Mm-hmm. I'll give Eastwood that. But a lot of Eastwood movies I'll watch, and I'm like, oh, man. So why Sandra Locke? Why?
Right.
It's like, why you got to cast your pixie hippie girlfriend when there were, you know, there's a whole town full of actresses.
My grandmother said, like, she had a hard time getting over Eastwood putting Sandra Locke in movies.
Everybody hated her. I talked to everybody, and I'm talking about, like, the working class Joe Lunchbucket types that was his audience. They hated her. Mm-hmm. Nobody liked her. I never talked to anybody who liked Sandra Locke.
Nobody ever goes, yeah, Sandra Locke was great in that. Never.
Yeah, you know, you talk to some redneck woman in the South, the type of people I grew up around, and they're like, why the hell did he put that damn woman in his movies? Damn ugly woman, can't even act. It's the ego on display. It was like, okay, I remember when we walked out of Stallone and Cobra, and everybody who's seen that in video like thinks that's a cool movie. It's like, everybody walked out of the theater going, I remember one guy saying to my dad, boy, he thinks too much of himself.
Yeah. Well, wasn't Cobra originally, like, wasn't that him basically taking what he developed for Beverly Hills Cop?
I heard that it had a lot of those elements. They took a Paula Gosling mystery suspense novel that was set in San Francisco, and Stallone grabbed it and kind of turned it into a Stallone vehicle.
Yeah, that's the Stallone in the 80s, man. A lot of it was just ego tripping.
The ego. look at my toupee.
Hey.
The Sly Cast guys are going to listen to us and hate this.
No, I know. Wait, I say hey. I was a Sylvester Stallone fan, but boy, like I saw Tango and Cash for the first time recently.
Oh,
boy,
man,
that's a piece of shit.
I saw that fucking thing opening night.
God, that movie sucked. Ugh.
And it's also more Stallone hates himself. Rambo is a pussy.
Oh, and he's like, he can't play the Fey, like, cop.
No.
Like, because he's sort of supposed to be the sort of metrosexual cop, you know?
And it's completely unbelievable. Hey, you gotta listen to opera.
Yeah, no,
You gotta wear some nice silk suits.
Yeah, it just didn't work. I saw it because it was directed by the guy who did Runaway Train.
Did you know it was actually finished by Albert Magnoli?
Yeah, I knew he didn't do the whole movie.
He actually directed the bulk of it, and it was. And Warner Brothers kind of just leaked it out over the Christmas holidays. Mm. They didn't really push it. It just kind of opened, and there was not a lot of promotion.
Yeah, like because I think
I remember going to see it. It's a mess of second unit stuff. That's all it is. And like that, the last 20 minutes, if that makes sense to you, good for you. Because it makes no sense. Because
it's all over the place tonally, and it definitely feels like a messy John Peters production. But I just saw it because Andre Kolchevsky worked on it, and I was such a fan of Runaway Train.
Albert Magnoli finished it, and Benny Urquiza, I believe, is fighting Kurt Russell at the end.
Okay.
But you cannot tell.
No, I wouldn't have known.
And it's Benny Urquiza. You know, these two kickboxers come out for no reason.
Yeah.
And start fighting Stallone and Kurt Russell. And one of them is Benny the Jet Urquiza. I think the other one was David Leo, who doubled for Michael Keaton in Batman. But don't quote me. It might be somebody else. But it was like, you can't tell who it is. You can't even see them. And I remember watching an interview with Benny Urquiza where he said he was fighting the end of that movie. I was like, oh, my God. They shot and edited it. So you couldn't even tell who it was. So like Jack Palance just sends them out.
Yeah, you know? Jack Palance. Yeah, that's another way you know it's a John Peters production. Is Jack Palance is the bad guy?
Tango and Cash.
We gotta go get Tango and Cash.
It was so bad. And Kurt Russell like admitted on the opening Anthony show. He goes because they said they watched it the other night. One of them had seen it the other night on cable and didn't care for it. He goes, and Kurt Russell's like, well, you know, it was made for 12-year-old boys.
Yeah, it totally is.
He said it was totally made for 12-year-old boys. No ifs and buts about it. No pretensions here. That's all it was made for.
I think that's how old my cousin was when he told me he saw that movie and it was awesome.
I remember I thought it was a big deal because they plagiarized the infamous bus scene from Jackie Chan's Police Story.
Oh, yeah, totally.
It's a homage. It's like, no, you're just stealing action scenes from Hong Kong movies because nobody's seen them.
Mm-hmm.
But I spotted it right away. And I think Stallone mentioned it later, that is a tribute to Jackie's.
Jackie, we were having lunch the other day.
It might have been better if they just had Jackie Chan co-star in the film.
No kidding.
I mean, he should have just brought him over to co-star in that. And that probably would have been a better film. It would have fit the tone since they were just going to rip off Police Story anyway. But not a good movie.
No, Tango and Cash, horrible. Anyways, so there you go. There's a third review.
Sorry, Slycast.
Sorry, guys.
Sorry, you won't be calling us intelligent anymore.
Yeah. I'm sure there's a decent Stallone movie we can talk about too.
There's a number of Stallone movies I love.
Yeah.
But, that's not one of them.
No, it's not.
Or Cobra.
No, I don't care for Cobra either. But I didn't see Cobra until I was like in my 20s, and
I saw it opening weekend. Oh my god! I thought it was gonna be good. Because the ads made it look
we're the Axe Gang.
It was like, oh my god, this looks like Dirty Harry, on steroids.
Right.
And the ads were apocalyptic, and the Jean Beauvoir music video.
I love the crime is a disease.
Yeah.
The cure.
Yeah.
That's so badass.
But you know what's so funny? That Sly's chewing on a matchstick inspired Chai Yun Fat to wear dark glasses and chew on a matchstick, and that became the most imitated look for young Chinese youth who lived in Chinatowns across the world.
Oh, Chow Yun-Fat was a trendsetter,
And he was basically doing Stallone's Cobra routine.
Yeah, that what was it? His look in A Better Tomorrow apparently was like a
big, he's doing Cobra. except he's wearing Alain Delon sunglasses.
Yeah, he's got those little French
and he's chewing on the matchstick, but it's the same thing. He's just doing Marion Cobretti.
Marion Cobretti.
Hey.
All right. So, anyways, that's. I think that about wraps it up for.
Hey, did we give you a show or what?
Hey.
It's like it's action packed.
We gave you a show, listeners. Thank you for coming one step beyond with us.
A mortal life is in danger tonight.
Yes. Lock your windows.
Yeah, but check them out. Horror anthologies.
Yes, they're quite lovely. I enjoy watching them with my wife. And yes.
And think about our terrible Vincent Price jokes.
When
you write our iTunes review, because we need iTunes reviews. I haven't seen a single one. We got thousands of listeners around the world. Not a single new iTunes review.
How dare they insinuate that Vincent Price was a homosexual? So it's like, homophobic.
Do you know how many boring podcasts get rave reviews like every week on iTunes?
So go give us a review on iTunes. Talk about my Vincent Price impersonation and how bad it is and give me
five
stars.
Do we need a British guy on the show? Is the fact we have an Australian? I don't know.
We don't need no pommy cunts.
Yeah. That's just because apparently if you've done something for the BBC and you have a British accent, your podcast is like, man, it's already respected. I don't listen to other film shows.
They take everything you say super seriously.
Yeah, I don't like to be. I don't want to be inspired by anybody.
No,
so yeah.
No.
And everybody's such a PC weirdo that like.
Well, that's the thing about movie podcasts for me is that like it's hard for me to find like I'm just gender politics.
Yeah.
And like sexual politics and just that's all taken over film criticism.
Yeah, it's boring.
And. Everybody, they're more concerned about whether or not something's racist or sexist
right.
than actually, like, getting... I want people to bring back base cinephilia. That's what I want back, you know?
Everybody's so obsessed with, like, Hitchcock is criticizing capitalism. No, he isn't. Hitchcock didn't give a shit. Hitchcock wasn't making movies for people in New York. Hitchcock made movies for the... The Joe Sixpacks across the country and the strap hangers. That's who he was making his movies.
He was just making a good thriller. Like
he wasn't loved by critics. Critics didn't like him until the French liked him.
Yeah, no, that was when
the French liked him. There was a revision of he was the Michael Bay of his day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was like all of those tacky Hitchcock thrillers that are made for people in the countryside to make fun of people in the city or whatever.
Right. Know? Yeah, no, it was there were a lot of directors in Hollywood who were considered great now who were not considered great until the François Truffauts and Jean-Luc Godards started saying they were great, and then filmmakers in America who loved their movies went, "Yes, that's the stuff we like, like Fritz Lang's movies in America were considered trash,
Yep.
A lot of John Ford's work was considered trash. Howard Hawks' work was considered trash. You know, and this is all considered, they're considered to be the great American filmmakers now.
Right.
But it was when the French, these like people like Godard and Truffaut were like, oh, actually, these are great filmmakers. And these filmmakers who wanted to imitate those, making those movies in the new Hollywood and stuff, they were the ones pushing. Like Peter Bogdanovich was a critic in America who was sort of this defender of Hawks and Ford and
right.
This producer I know, he said that he would get into arguments with Bogdanovich because he said that Bogdanovich would defend even like really bad Hawks movies. Because he said, he goes, listen, this guy, he comes from a time when these directors were hated, so he feels the need to defend everything. He doesn't realize, he doesn't need to do that now because they're considered great,
Yeah, it kind of reminds me that critics are reading so much into Sergio Leone's work that they were like, oh, he studies Marxism and all that. And
wasn't he kind of a commie, though?
Okay, here's the funny thing about Sergio Leone. He grew up on a movie set. He was like the Quentin Tarantino of his day.
Yeah.
He just absorbed movies. That's all he knew. He grew up on a movie set. He just knew movies. And then when he read all this friggin' dissection of his work that it's Marxism, and then so he made sure he was always photographed by a shelf of books to look like he was an intellectual. So he would have photos taken of himself with all these books. He never picked up any of them.
The only reason I thought that was because I thought that Duck, You Sucker sort of had a string of...
It was, and it's the type of Marxism that comes from a simplistic reading of it.
Okay.
And not analyzing all aspects of it. It's like just reading a little stuff about revolution. Okay, Duck, You Sucker. He thought Duck, You Sucker was something they said in America. Like I every day I call you up, hey Hunter, duck you sucker.
Duck you sucker. We should,
he thought that was an American.
Let's do
saying.
That. Let's do
you
that.
You know, Eastwood said he was clueless, where it was just like he goes, hey, he'd be dressed up like a cowboy in the set and he looked like Yosemite Sam.
Well, wasn't like because there was kind of a period in spaghetti westerns where they had all these kind of commie themes, right?
They did, and I mean guys like Corbucci were commies and stuff.
Oh, totally.
But the movies are completely right wing.
Right. Well, like Django's totally like, you know.
Yeah, they're right wing individualistic fantasies. Yeah. It's like I guess all these commies dreamed of being Randians.
Yeah. they really
and my friend Mike Malloy, his movie Eurocrime, his documentary. It analyzes that most of the filmmakers of these Italian crime films were communist, but the movies are completely right wing.
Well, isn't that like, kind of, doesn't that kind of, maybe you could read into that by saying that like the mind of the communist is the mind of the totalitarian. You know, I want to be in control of stuff.
Right. I want to be a strong man in control of things.
Yeah. I want to be the Iron Man, Joseph Stalin, you know.
It's like P.J. O'Rourke said about liberals that call you a Nazi. He says, well, just feel good that no woman has ever fantasized about being ravished by a liberal. I'm paraphrasing, but that's pretty much the
joke. I think that's a good note to go out on.
Yes.
All right, find us at MidnightMovieCowboys.com. Leave us a rating and review on iTunes. Or just write a blog post about how we're racist or something. Yeah.
That gets us hits, buddy.
Yeah. Oh, it does. I'm sorry. When you say our Cannonball Run 2 episode is the most racist thing you've ever heard or most evil thing you've ever heard, I love it. That just it's validation, baby.
So. It's like, can't say that about the other podcast.
So, MidnightMovieCowboys.com, MidnightMovieCowboys@gmail.com. Look us up on Twitter at MMCowboys, Facebook. Check out the page and the group. It's all there. And come over there, show us some love. All right? Anything all else, right. John?
No, that's it.
Adios.
No mahalo.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. For more information, go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. For feedback, comments, or show suggestions, go to midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like what you hear? Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Hear us on Stitcher Radio. Head over to Stitcher.com and download the app. Want to help the show out? Head on over to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Find us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Like us on Facebook. Head over to Facebook.com. Type in Midnight Movie Cowboys. Hit the like button over there. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and find the links from there on the right hand side. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.